in the dirt. Digging in the dirt.
This is Digging in the Dirt with Kevin Gallagher, where Kevin and his guests dig a little deeper into today's issues surrounding the environment, farming, gardening, and food.
And my next guest on Digging in the Dirt is a neighbor of ours here at WPGN, just up the road on I-95. He's Mark Bromford. He's the director of Yale's Sustainable Food Program. As a farmer, educator, advocate, and leader, Mark has spent the last two decades immersed in creating sustainable food systems. Mark was the founding director for the Center for Sustainable Food Systems at the University of British Columbia. Mark joined Yale University as the director for the Yale Sustainable Food Program back in 2011, and under the theme of food literate leadership, Mark aspires to position the Yale Sustainable Food Program at the forefront of a global movement for the change in our food system. Welcome, Mark Bromford.
Thank you, Kevin.
How are you?
I'm doing quite well, thank you.
That's good. So, what is food literate leadership, and why do we need it?
Right. Food literate leadership addresses some of the overlooked structures that really drive and determine what kind of farming is easy to do, what kind of farming is difficult to do, what kind of farming we incentivize and we disincentivize. So when I say food literate leadership, the literacy piece has a critical component to it. It's not just knowing what is the good thing to eat or the good way to farm. It's understanding how you think of a complex system, and more importantly, how you change a complex system, which you can never know in its entirety. The leadership piece kind of moves to that. It says that we need to change underlying structures. It's not just a matter of aspiring for the best practice and trying to repeat or replicate or scale that up. There's a lot of system work that needs to be done. And that's where we're trying to prepare Yale's graduates who are involved with the farm and with the sustainable food program. Some of them may end up being farmers. I certainly hope that we'll get a couple good farmers in the mix. But, they'll end up being people in civic leadership positions. They may end up being in finance. They may end up being public policy and politics. All of those things that kind of underlie many of the things that we can't decide on directly, that's where we want our students to be positioned.
So you're taking sort of a broad approach to it in trying to teach a variety of types of people as they move forward into the world and their careers.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. So are we going to see some corporate leaders coming out of this, and maybe they're going to make changes?
Yeah, we already have, actually. When I arrived here, I had come from more of a traditional agricultural background, and I had worked and taught in a university. We don't have land grants the same as you do here in the United States back in Canada, but it was still a kind of conventional agricultural university. And when I came to Yale, I was really interested to know what's the niche, what's the kind of competitive advantage where Yale would be able to make a difference in the food system. And it wasn't in trying to recreate a traditional agricultural school, right? That would be a sort of silly approach, quite frankly. And so it was asking, where do Yale's graduates end up? And the positions that you find Yale's graduates in, those positions, how do they affect food and agriculture? So, if someone is, say, on a consulting track and is ending up doing kind of financial services consulting with a business like McKinsey or Bain, obviously the way that they move capital around the world has profound impacts on the daily lives of people farming here, there, and everywhere. It has profound impacts on the lives of people who are eating. So what can you accomplish if you put someone in that position with a first-hand knowledge about the farmers and the eaters whose lives they are ultimately affecting? And that's kind of what we're doing. And we have seen some of our graduates end up exactly in those kind of positions, with a first-hand understanding of where their decisions end up impacting farms and farmers and eaters all over the world. So I'm quite excited by the potential there. Obviously, it's a bit of a long-term game, but the early results look good.
Huh. So, for example, you may want to get somebody involved in this that may be a banker at some point and is lending money to farm, like large farms that do tilling, for instance, that makes, and maybe they're going to switch over to no-till machines and things like that. Is that sort of the idea?
That could be part of the idea. Currently I'm excited by some of the our graduates who are looking into capital access for smaller farmers, because that's actually a tremendous barrier. Many small farmers around the world could take that next step and could move towards viability. They've got the know-how, they've got the markets, but they just need some kind of key small piece of capital, for example. It could just be a new machine. It could be an upgrade to, an irrigation system or something along those lines. It could be like a missing piece in their transportation infrastructure. But, the big banks aren't going to look at them. And now we have graduates who are actually working for some capital firms that specialize in supporting the smaller scale farmers in need of capital, not just outside the United States, but in the United States too. So I'm really excited about that aspect as well. I mean, what we're trying to promote here is diversification on all fronts, right? It's the idea that the future is not going to be exclusively small farms, but it's also not going to be exclusively large farms. I think if you're talking about resilience and if you're talking about what kind of food systems might work for the long term, you're going to see diversity across scales, across different types, across structures, all that kind of stuff. So it's making sure that our students are there in all the places that might be overlooked as drivers of food system change and might be in need of some kind of careful, literate, and compassionate attention.
Huh. That's an interesting thing to say about the whole system. I mean, there's a lot going on. I'm going up to the BioNutrient Food Association convention tomorrow, and that is a gathering of a lot of people worried about healthy soil and distribution of food, healthy food, local farm-to-table kind of stuff, even small, promoting small farms. They'd be interested in what you just said about getting money for small farms and small distribution systems that is not available to them. And another subject that comes up all the time is like farm crop insurance too, which seems to be a barrier to a lot of change in the farming world. And are these kind of things being taught in these courses that you have under this program at Yale?
Yeah, absolutely. I wish that I was able to do more. Right now we have about 40 courses each year in the college that deal with topics related to contemporary food and agricultural problems. And in some cases these are courses that actually take sort of historical perspectives to help better understand some of the patterns that we're seeing today. There's about 40 courses, but we could use 10 times that number, I think, to really give students a sense as to the diversity of challenge, but also the diversity of opportunity which exists out there today. One of the ways we try and overcome this lack of courses is through this new fellowship that we launched about 3 years ago now, called the Global Food Fellowship. And the idea there is that we get our students out of Yale University's gates, and it doesn't matter if their placement is with a community NGO right here in New Haven or whether it's with an organization in Ethiopia. We want them to see something which is completely different than everything they have learned from books or on the Yale farm at the university. And we want them to gain that sort of diversity of experience so they can see, okay, context matters a whole lot. And before I go into a situation with ideas about what constitutes a sustainability or what is good for its resilience or something like that, I have to understand the context. And so part of what we're teaching them through that fellowship are strategies, I think, for being incredibly observant, for keeping your eyes wide open, keeping your ears wide open to listening and seeing and understanding what's going on around you, and reserving your urge to help unless you are specifically asked to do so. So, part of what I'm thinking is that structurally and systemically, food systems of tomorrow don't need any more great men or great books or great leaders or great big ideas. And so it's kind of that more rhizomatic approach of small initiatives, probably working from the grassroots, working interdependently, seeing how that might give rise to the sorts of problem solving that we're going to need to deal with some of the challenges that are coming down the pike, I suppose. So that's a bit of a long answer, but we don't have enough courses, and the way that we try and compensate for that is through field experiences, working on the ground in the community.
So what kind of problems or crises do we see before us that such a program is necessary?
Yeah. Well, obviously the big one is climate change, right? And I don't think you've got any disagreement over that, that this is going to provide huge challenges for agriculture to have to adapt to. I think that it may not be recognized because so many of the models that deal with long-term climatic changes kind of just assume that because we'll have this average increase in the global surface temperature, that perhaps we can model out and test out how our crops perform under this increased temperature and increased CO2. But of course, that's not really representative of what's coming. What we understand might be more representative is just pure climate chaos, if you will, and the increased incidence of extremes, the increased incidence of floods, the increased incidence of drought, the increased incidence of basically too much of a good thing or not enough of a good thing, all at the wrong time in the wrong place, right? So it's trying to figure out how our food production systems will be able to adapt to those new heights of instability. And we know that that instability is coming regardless of what actions we take in the next decade. Much of it is basically preloaded into the global Earth system. And so the need for adaptation is absolutely critical. And some of that adaptation is not going to just be with what you would consider to be technologies in the natural and physical sciences, new things, new materials, all that kind of stuff. Some of it is going to be innovations in the socioeconomic sphere. Mm-hmm. And so those are the ones where we need to have ways to talk to each other about these complex problems. We need to have ways to cooperate. We need to have understanding of what's happening somewhere over on the other side of the world, because one of the implications of much more uncertainty in the weather is that there's probably going to be more of a necessity for globalized interdependence, which is often difficult because it sounds paradoxical when I've just said we need to be working from the grassroots. But the fact is that no individual bioregion, no matter how resilient its cropping system's design have become, would be able to get a good harvest off if it happens to be 3 feet underwater. Similarly, if there's no water whatsoever, very difficult for an annual cropping system to make it through that at all. And so it does mean that some of these socioeconomic technologies to make sure that trade is working and that it's fair, that's going to be part of the picture too.
Mm-hmm. I see. And so a lot of your students and graduates of this program are trying to work through these problems. I know that it's like wide system scale kind of learning and decision making, but when they learn all this stuff and they go out into the world, what I'm curious about is the corporations and the governments embracing them and hiring them to come in and say, hey, we need some of this long range planning to figure out what we're going to do, how it's going to affect our bottom line, how is it going to affect the populace?
They are, but as you can imagine, it's also mixed. Somebody who was going off to do stuff at the USDA would be getting a very different reception right now than they would have a year ago, right? It's also mixed in the approach that corporations are taking. The large multinational agribusiness, they all are deeply concerned about sustainability. They know, for example, that the supply chains they depend on for their survival are brittle and have problems not just when it comes to how they're going to face climate change, but also problems with the future of the genetics there, and most importantly, the future of the people in those supply chains. Many of them have been based on, a level of exploitation that I think the people who are managing these supply chains and asking questions about their long-term survival realize is not part of the sustainable solution either. So you have a lot of interest and a lot of demand for expertise for people who understand sustainability within the context of an agricultural supply chain, an agri-food supply chain. One of the interesting challenges, and this is where the kind of critical literacy comes into it, is that, of course, every different firm is going going to have a vastly different understanding of what sustainability means to them. And in some cases, their ideas about what's important in sustainability could be working at cross purposes with the ideas that you might have coming out of an NGO or out of a scientific report or out of a government agency. And so, you know, it means that our students who are in these positions actually have to navigate these differences, and they have to understand why the messages that they're getting purportedly working towards the same ultimate ends seem to be so different, and be able to assess basically, you know, what is useful for right now, and what is not useful, and how can they help to steer often not particularly nimble institutions through these fairly muddied waters.
Yeah, I'll say. And especially under the climate that, you, as you mentioned before, the Trump administration has provided probably a lot of your graduates, but also the people actually working in all these areas.
Well, let's just say that hiring is up in nonprofits and hiring is down in the public sector.
Okay, that's a good... So... one of the just one more thing about this, this, you know, the way, you know, I look at it as college courses, you know, but I guess it's a little bit deeper than that. But I know there's a crisis in soil right now in the United States, in the world. There is a depletion of anything good in soil. We've done a lot of overuse of nitrogen chemicals and also in pesticides, and the soil is pretty much devoid of any kind of life. And there is a whole new movement to go towards better soil by doing it differently than a lot of the massive institutions are doing, or even the government, which is sometimes controlled by these institutions. So are you teaching your people about this stuff, and are they're going to go out and try to affect change in this area, or you see where I'm going with this? I'm trying to figure out how practical change can happen.
Yeah. You know, I mean, soil is not surprisingly at the foundation of many of our conversations, right?
Yes.
And understanding what soil quality looks like, given how different the sort of like contexts are around the world, where you've got, you know, very different kind of soil climate complex going on. You know, sort of same answer as last question. We don't have enough courses in it. We have a couple courses in soil science that are actually offered out of the Graduate School of Forestry and Environmental Studies, and are also taken by our undergraduates. And we do parts of those courses right at the Yale Farm, actually, which is good because the students get an opportunity to sort of like firsthand, you know, understand, you know, a kind of identification diagnostic, the kind of taxonomy work that goes into identifying how a soil formed and where it might be going, and then looking at various soil quality indicators that might be appropriate given your site. We do, at the Yale Farm, we do exhaustive soil testing. We have basically we're doing far much more testing than we need to, but that's mostly because it's part of the learning experience, and the students are involved in the sort of understanding of sampling design and understanding a methodology to figure out how you might assess you know, an often subjective sense of soil quality where you are. So we're talking a lot about it, for sure. The I think that some of the concern you know, that, you know, emerged from Albrecht's work back in Missouri and maybe has been exacerbated now by the recent kind of stoichiometric work regarding what happens to the concentration of simple sugars versus mineral nutrients in produce as you have rising CO2 levels, right? Are you familiar with that?
Yes.
With those studies that just came out? So, I mean, I think that, you know, some of those ideas of nutrient depletion as well as sort of nutrient dilution, right, those have spurred a lot of interest in, you know, what do we do about the soil? How do we get the soil to a state where it's, you know, providing foods which are as they were back in the good old days, I suppose. That's also a difficult one because the answers are not cut and dry, and it also kind of can lead you down to this trap of ending up imagining health is something which can be described with fairly few indicators. It can as you approach the idea of nutrient depletion in soils, so you can also potentially go down the kind of reductionist road of nutritionism that Michael Pollan spoke about in Defense of Food in that book. And so the danger there in my thinking is that I don't want to have nutrient scares from soil end up informing a reductionist view of what constitutes human health. Because I do think there's this idea that if you start to obsess about the nutrient in the carrot, that it's with the idea that you also need to make up this particular complement of nutrients, and if you achieve this particular complement of nutrients in your diet, then you're going to achieve health. And of course, the same as a plant, that's only a tiny, tiny portion of the story. Much like the plant, all the conditions of your environment, some of which you have a say in, some of which you don't, are going to be huge contributors to what your health is like as a person or as a soil or as a farm. Right? And so I guess I'm pleased that there is the attention that the kind of concern over nutrient loss, I'm pleased that this attention has been brought to soil and it's been brought to the nutritional composition of our food. But I would like to deepen that conversation and ask where are we going with this, and what does it say about our perception of what a healthy person is, and how far are we willing to draw those boundaries as to what we say constitutes health and what we say does not constitute health, because I think that that one can get quite problematic if you reduce it to a too thin simplification.
I guess. Anyway, I guess whether you get disease or not could have a lot to do with it, you know, from what you're eating, you know, so.
Well, this is the thing, right, is that there's few kind of like, you know, smoking gun, single cause, sort of point source factors that contribute towards health or ill health. And, you know, one of the conversations that we're involved in with other universities right now, including Davis, you know, which certainly has the Old Guard land grant there, is, you know, can we even develop a vocabulary for what health means? Right now, when we talk about humans, we have a very detailed vocabulary for what illness means, but we don't have a very good vocabulary for what good health is. And I feel similarly like we're lacking some of that vocabulary and understanding for soil quality and for soil health, right? We have language of depletion, there's not a great understanding model or language out there for what actually constitutes balance, what might constitute health, and what might constitute good soil quality for a given context and for a given outcome, which ultimately is subjective, and that's part of its beauty.
Mm-hmm. So are you optimistic about the future? You think you're going to see real change through programs like your own and other universities that are helping form the leadership of the future?
Well, I'm paid to be optimistic, but I also am optimistic, and you can decide whether that's a cop-out answer. it's hard not to be optimistic when you see the kind of interest, the passion, the drive, which is behind our students who want to learn about these issues, want to make a difference. And even more difficult to be pessimistic when you see that they are they're sharp enough to not fall into some of the old patterns that got us into this problem, right? So I think that they are approaching these problems with a lot more humility than some of their predecessors might have approached them with. I think there's a much better understanding, at least from the students that I work with, that we are inhabiting systems that are beyond our complete control and are also beyond our complete knowledge. And I guess that kind of application of realizing that we're not going to get the whole thing, and yet we still have to know how to care for it, that's a slightly different philosophy. Well, actually, it's a drastically different philosophy than drove some of the kind of agricultural development and extension efforts in the past century. So, I'm incredibly optimistic. These are people who, the students are people who care, they're compassionate, they are critical and self-reflexive. I think the challenging future is in good hands in that sense.
That's good to hear. So we're talking to Mark Bromford. He's the head of the Yale Sustainable Food Program up at Yale in New Haven. And you mentioned the farm. Tell us, we have a few more minutes. Why don't you tell us about the farm? Well, how big is it, and what are you growing there, and where does the produce go after they've grown it?
Sure. Well, it's called the Yale Farm, which is a little bit tongue-in-cheek because it is exactly 1 acre. So it is, 640th the size of the farm that I grew up on. But what we're trying to say there is we want people to get their head into thinking about what a farm is. One of the nice educational pieces about a single acre is that that acre statistically is what it takes to feed one statistically average American a statistically average diet over the course of a year. So it actually allows you to kind of like ground and make real this idea of what it takes to sustain health, right? And so that's important. They grow a whole range of things on that 1 acre, your general mixed vegetable production inspired by Elliot Coleman, but also moving more into perennial polycultures inspired by Eric Tonesmeyer and other people who have been working with kind of perennial agroforestry. So it's changing, and it changes every year. We have our laying hens, we have our honeybees, and the students every Friday, they get a great harvest from our high tunnels, from our fields, from our hedgerows, and so forth. And some of it ends up going on to the pizzas that they make every nice Friday afternoon right there on the farm, and the rest goes the following morning to the Worcester Square Farmers Market, and then to some of the finer New Haven restaurants. That's one of the best ways for the students to actually get face-to-face contact with people in the broader New Haven community who they otherwise wouldn't necessarily see that much of behind Yale gates.
Yeah, get down and dig in the dirt a little bit.
They do that.
That's good. Well, thank you for coming on and tell us about the program. I'm glad one of my colleagues here told me about your program. So I said, I'd like to know something that's going on in my own backyard. So that's kind of nice. I thank you for coming on and explaining what's happening. And I hope a lot of your students learn a whole bunch of stuff and they can help us out here in the agriculture area.
You bet. Thank you,
Kevin. We'll talk to you later.
Okay. Bye now.
Digging in the dirt. Digging in the dirt.
You've been listening to Digging in the Dirt with Kevin Gallagher.